Hi, Malcolm.
I'm here, Mark.
Okay, fantastic.
Now, you say some message here. Please do something so it can be recorded.
Yeah, don't worry. It's all done.
It's all done. That's fine.
It's all done.
So how's the quality of the sound?
It's perfect.
That's good. So we're in fine style with a sign on the door saying, under no circumstances, interrupt me on pain of death.
All right. So are we ready to get started?
Sure.
All right. Excellent. Hi, I'm Dr. Mark Dassault, the Exponential Growth Strategist, and I'm here with Professor Malcolm Simons, and we're having a special conversation today. First of all, Malcolm, thank you very much for taking time out of your day today to have this conversation. We've chatted over the last little while to make this happen, and I really appreciate the fact that you are taking this time. Just to give you a little bit of a history of what I know of Malcolm, I actually don't know how I came across him originally, but I can tell you that in the past year and a half or so, or 2 years maybe, that I've known him, he's been an inspiration to me. As a squash player, I think that's where we kind of connected with a similar interest in sport and achievement. But it transcends sport, as you'll hear in this conversation. So why don't we just jump right in, Malcolm, and why don't you tell us... what I thought I would do before we get started is I'm just going to ask you a whole bunch of questions, and this isn't scripted. So if you're listening to this, it's completely live. It's raw, unedited. Malcolm has given me permission to ask him questions, and you'll see the excitement in his voice and why we're doing this. So first of all, Malcolm, what's your prognosis right now?
Somewhere between 4 to 12 weeks. Depending upon whether it proves that the drugs are causing the progressive kidney failure or that reflects an inexorable development of the myeloma.
So just so we're clear, you're dying.
Well, the problem with this is I've been dying since the Catalyst program in 2002.
Exactly.
And everybody's tired, starting from a family, of hearing me dying. And what happens is that you go through these waves where on the one hand I try and prepare everybody as best I can, but on the other hand I have to say that I've come into this treatment at the end of the first decade of this century where there are a range of treatments available that simply weren't available when the figures of a median survival of 3 years was given. So now people are living 10 years and more, and I'm one of them, fortunately. And so what I have to do is balance the possibility that this is inexorable and prepare for a quiet, smooth, peaceful departure. But on the other hand, basically live in every second of the day, as I do about 18 to 20 hours a day. That's my average day at the moment. And have everybody ready while saying to them, guys, you've all been here before. I can keep you informed, but I can't tell you what the inevitability is.
If someone's listening to this, they're obviously shocked that we're talking to someone who's at the end of his life. Whether you have 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 years, you know that you're at the end of your life. How do you deal with the fact that in your case, you've had multiple diagnoses, if you will, or prognoses, and you've overcome so many of them? Without focusing on the disease as much, how do you now deal with that kind of pressure that most people who are listening to this can't believe that your voice is so strong, you're positive, your syntax is positive, the vocabulary that you use is always uplifting? I've been listening to you now for 2 years, and let me tell you.
So right back to medical school days, I developed an interest in a philosophy called existentialism. That means there's only now.
Yep.
Everybody's both living and dying. There's only now. And the advantage that I have is that I've had to put him a face closer than most. If everybody took this approach and dealt with it as if every second that they've got is as precious as I see every second I've got, there's no issue. You just live that way. And I've lived that way all my life, including right through this area, right through 5 divorces, right through 2 attempted suicides, right through a lot of stuff. I've recovered when I depart from my now, here, now, this is all I've got, I lose the plot. When I get in back into my now and capture my blessings, no matter how apparently difficult my circumstances, then it's a different matter. So this is no change. And everybody listening to this would be well advised to imagine that they've got the advantage that they haven't driven into a tree or dropped dead from a heart attack. And they should take advantage of what circumstances they have. Get ready for it. And then there's a mental ease and quietude which enables you to be what is the only thing that matters, and that is an inspiration to other people around so that their life works better as a result of interacting with me.
The amazing thing, Malcolm, and we've only known each other for about 2 years, is that I've known of your illness, you know, throughout that time. And I tell you this not because I don't care for you. You know how deeply I care for you. Is I've never felt sorry for you. I've met other people who've had, you know, other illnesses or ailments or afflictions, or call it whatever you will, not even terminal, and I felt sorry for them because they couldn't help themselves. You seem to have lived a life and still live a life that is so rich in on a mental and emotional and spiritual level that I find captivating. And every time I'm talking to you, I mean, I'm a pretty excitable guy because, you know, I'm positive and what have you. But whenever I'm talking to you, I can just sense the energy that you have. Go back to when you started having this existential mindset of living in the present and the now. How did you get that started, and how has that evolved over time? And then how do you feel that that's contributed to the quality of life you've been able to have for the last decade or so?
Well, when I was 16 or 17 in third or fourth year medical school, I had the fortune to be in contact with colleagues who were with Ed Hillary climbing the Himalayas. Wow. And there were guys there who were top of their field in mathematics, in theology, and in other places. And one guy, Jim Wilson, wrote his theology thesis on acting as if. And it hit me. And then I got a lot of interest in existentialism, not the negative nihilism of Nietzsche, but the positive affirmative side of it, which is the side that I'm only prepared to recognize.
Sure.
And then during the, 60 years, I guess, or 58 years, during the 58 years since then, as I said before, I've held to that as best I possibly can. So in my deepest fit of depression, which was at the beginning of this decade, 10 years ago, I was living on a stolen mattress in the snow in Germany. I then was living under the road in hot Hong Kong. So I hit the pits. And I would start each day when I woke by listing what it was that was working for me. And it's no different from this morning. I woke up at 5:30 this morning. It's a perfect day. I'm in a hospice. The sun is shining through beautiful glass windows. And I'm thinking, my goodness me, what a marvelous day to do whatever, whatever. Now, what are my priority lists today? And then I go through and I put that listing down, and it's different from yesterday because I've been asleep for 4 hours, so that the stuff has come in. And so I rearrange stuff according to what works. And then out there are people who are waiting to hear where I'm at. And so my life is about finishing what I'm doing, but doing it in a manner where I'm having the most positive influence that I can on people, starting from a family. And so they know if I'm like that, there's nothing to regret. There's nothing to be sorry about. The guy says he's had a marvelous life. I have. He seems to be continuing to enjoy it. I have. I like to be around him. Most people have no idea how to go and visit someone who's dying. They don't know what to say after, well, how are you? If they come in to see me, I'm hoping I'm showing sufficient courage that all that we do is move into a conversation, which has got nothing to do with my demise.
That's right.
And so that's the issue. You live to influence in as positive a manner as many people as you possibly can, because you have no idea, no idea at all who you're influencing for the better. You've just got to be yourself, be this sort of now is now is now, and that's all you've got person. And years later, students come up to me and say, you know, in 1963 I got this lecture from you at Monash, or in 19 something or other, I heard you in Paris or something. And so every second you have to imagine that responsibility of influencing people, and you can either influence them for what I'll call not in their interests, or something which lifts them out of where they are and they aspire to do. And they say, God, if that guy can do it, that's what they say these days. If that guy can, I mean, I was playing with you in the Australian Masters 2 years ago.
Yep.
So, you know, I've, and it's a long time since I played for Australia. That's 1966. But I've had to completely change the sort of man I am. I've lost all my muscle bulk. I can barely walk and this and that and the other. But I'm who I am now.
But you've been who you are now for so many years. Why care in this time, in this age of everybody being so self-centered and not really caring about community? And you know, we see the issues around the world. But if we just bring it back from a community perspective, why would you care about other people, and why have you cared so much about other people, you know, throughout your career? And I'm a proponent of, you know, giving of yourself and having the power of the human spirit, you know, overcome, you know, amazing things. But from your perspective, why would someone today, especially the younger generation, should they care about other people and the influence they have on them and the inspiration that they can give when
it's damn simple, Mark. It's damn simple, because like democracy, every one of us counts. We mightn't see what happens as we're doing it. But I committed to what I called ANZ Asia in the mid-60s. That was to take Australian and New Zealand science into Asia. And I've committed to that ideology for the whole of my life. And so I've brought Japan into the society. I've moved it up from Southeast Asia to now Asia Pacific. On Tuesday next week, I go and they're honoring me with an annual lecture, which they're delivering before I die, because they reckon there's no point in delivering it after. I'm not going to hear much there. Thursday next week, you know, they're acknowledging the fact that for, what is it, 38 years, I've been moving that way. I brought the Chinese into it last year. Now, that's one person, and that's what anyone who's listening can do. So you don't stop and ask, oh, well, what can one do? What can if I stop one cigarette? What can if I have one less glass of wine? Forget about it. Decide if that's what you want to do, then you do it. You do it to the absolute fullest that you possibly can. And whether or not in your lifetime you see the outcome of it, well, it'd be nice. But if you don't, you've set something in motion, and some people somewhere will pick up on it. That's the way the world has evolved since time immemorial, and there's no reason to change it.
Now, how many wives and children do you have? Because when I first met you, the numbers were a little baffling to me. So tell me, how many wives and how many children?
Well, I'm a serial monogamist, so I only have one at a time.
I understand that, but how many?
But at the moment, I'm fortunate to have my sixth wife is also my fifth wife, because yes, we went through a divorce.
And you remarried?
Last Sunday, I was with my, second wife and her children. And my first wife's a professor of English in England, and I speak to her. Third wife I'm not in contact with. Fourth wife is its mother of two other children. So I have six biological children by three marriages, and all but one chooses not to be in contact. But from last Sunday, when I have my granddaughter's birthday and my four of my sons in the one room, and daughter and an ex-wife, and my current wife is just unbelievable the way she has transcended the family processes and held them all together. So for me, although I do a lot, last Sunday was what was the event that I'll think of when I'm fading. Family is the lot, and that's got to be the major priority in your life, even if you've only got one child or one parent or whatever it is. So work on it to make that happen.
So having that many families, wives, children, is that reckless? Is it self-serving, or is it you living the life to the fullest?
No, it's a selfish life and a fortune.
See,
no,
I love that about you. You don't even try to self-validate. You just say it's a selfish life.
It's a selfish life. And my first wife has written a beautiful piece which explains how difficult it is to live with someone like me who's got a limitless energy. But I was so I was so Victorian male-oriented of thinking that home was just an emotional base and I'd go out in the world and conquer it in some way or other, and sometimes I'd get some money to bring home and sometimes I wouldn't. But for the wives, that was a terribly thoughtless, inconsiderate existence. And frankly, I'm glad that it's only in the last period of time, helped greatly by Landmark Education, that Anne and I have had a review of it, and we've decided that the knapsack full of rocks of 50 years of Victorian practice just has to stop. So now I hope I spend quite a bit more time thinking about Anne and helping her with her career, but I know that I'm still focused on what I have to do, but at least I'm conscious of trying to do something about it. So you can change even if you're in your 60s or 70s, and you have to change because these days, you know, gender doesn't matter, whereas I perpetuated the gender differential myth for a period of time, and that didn't help any of the wives. So it's no wonder that they got tired of being with this phenomenon after a period of time.
You speak with a little bit of wisdom there, but I don't sense regret. You have an acknowledgement of what took place. When you look back upon it, I don't think you have regret, but if you do, you can tell me. What are your learnings from that, beyond what you've just said, that you recognize maybe your shortcomings or your perspective should have been different? When you look back on it, without saying would you change anything, when you look back on it, how do you see all of that? And
you go with what you see at the time. I'm writing the biography at the moment, and I remember at the end of Singapore in 1976, I was undergoing a divorce to my second wife, and the children were coming back to Australia, and I had the choice of coming back to Australia and trying to gain access to them, or going to Manila to work for the World Health Organization on $280,000 tax-free dollars a year, which was a fortune in that day. And in terms of my ideology, it would have been better to go to Manila. Would I have done it differently now? No, I'm damn glad I came here, even though it wasn't easy to settle in and earn enough to manage and all. And why was that? Because I've ended up in a circumstance which is utterly impossible to predict with, four more children, and a range of experiences in life that say it's all very well being smart that you would have done it differently, but I'm damn glad I was practicing what I practiced at the time. There's always a choice. You may not pick the right choice. You might look back and you might say, oh dear, what a pity I went that way. But you didn't. You're here now, and there's opportunity here now. Excuse me a minute. Thank you. You're here now, and you just continue on with making it possible for those you're with, including those ex-wives, to show them the understanding like I'm expressing here now, so that there's nothing they can say. They can't say, well, what a prick, he's still carrying on as if, you know, there was no alternative.
Yep, I understand. When you look back on your professional and personal life, what are your greatest accomplishments and why do they matter to you now, beyond having children, which obviously a parent would always mention at the top of their list? What do you think your greatest accomplishments were? But more importantly, why do they matter to you now when you look back upon your life and who you've become and how that influenced, you know, the course of your life and the trajectories that you took?
I think that – oh, bother. I am sorry.
That's
I can't
right.
do much
That's
about right. it. I am proud of the fact that I persevere. I sustain interests. I don't flip around. So the major things I've done is pick up on the genetics of cancer in the 1970s after picking up on the ideology in the 1960s by going to Singapore at a time when everybody went to England and America, and people said to me, hey, you dumbo, that's not going to help your career. You'll never become a professor that way. But it coincided with my ideology. And since then, I've pursued it such that last year I was appointed a professor at the Chinese University in Guangzhou, the prestige cancer center in China. That doesn't happen to too many 71-year-olds. And I was up there in 79 putting in the first workshop there, which is only a few years after Kissinger and Australia had an embassy there. So I've kept on with the science, the ideology, I've tried to review how I live my life in terms of the others, and I'm now bringing it to a close. So that the what keeps me going is that even though I might only have weeks or months, it is realistic for me to imagine a closure on some of these important things that I do. So I'm working very hard to do what I do. And in the last year, I guess what we've created in the science, genetic science, is a revolution. And I'm hoping to be well enough to go to China on Tuesday week to present at a Chinese-French Congress and tell them that we're going to have to rethink the entire way we've looked about the genetics of viral-associated cancer. So to be doing that at my stage as a completion of what I set off in the 70s, which in turn is a tradition of Mendel and in turn Darwin, that's a pretty satisfying sort of a process to imagine that I'm part of.
The research that you're doing is completely independent of the disease that you have, right?
Yes, yes. There are two types of cancer, just so people can pick up a bit while they're here.
Yep.
There are two types of cancer. One where the chromosomes break and they rejoin in a manner which is inappropriate. So you get cancer proteins formed which produce that particular cancer. And that corresponds to about 80% of leukemias and 20% of solid tumors. And so if you can work out a way, and I think we have, there's an inventor I work with called Greg Allen, who's got a patent in this area. I think there's a way to deal with that. And then I've got the other type, which is that somewhere up and down the track of where the genes matter, there's a failure of the ability to regulate the expression of the genes. So mine is in the other area. It's much more difficult. I haven't looked at it. Why haven't I looked at it? I guess because I'm not an expert in that area, and because when I read everything, the first sentence says multiple myeloma is an incurable plasma cell, and survival is so and so and so and so. That's not too heartening to keep reading that. So I've differentiated into what I know about, and I'll leave to others the hope that they can pick up on the sort of tumor I've got and others have got, and do something about it.
When you look at your accomplishments, do you feel any of them were empty or not as worthy of the effort that you put in when you look back on them now? In other words, did you chase something that you thought once you caught it wasn't worth the chase?
No.
So they were all worth the chase? Explain to me why, because a lot of people don't chase something because they don't think it'll be worth it. Why are you so definitive? And that's what I expected as your answer. Why are you so definitive about that?
Well, I guess the answer to it is, how did you get started and what did you do about it? So, for example, when I'm in Singapore, I'm there primarily to look at the new way of using blood typing, tissue typing, to cancer. If that hadn't worked, or if we hadn't have ended up in 1975 as the citation in the National Cancer Institute around the world, as the one who'd shown how to move this genetics into human disease, everybody knew about mice, but to move it into human disease, I would have had to review it. But why would you review it when you're onto a winning thing? But if you look at it and say, well, this ain't going no place, you've got to review it and say, well, how is this the best use of my time? Is there another way to use my time? So the quicker you do that in whatever you want to pursue, then the more likely you are to be fully occupying your time with stuff that actually is worth chasing.
And yeah, you've had a long life, so you've chased things that haven't always worked. So,
which are like what?
I don't know, whatever hasn't worked. Whatever.
Well, marriage hasn't worked. I've addressed that.
So let's look at that without getting into the personal details.
Yeah.
Why don't you regret having those marriages?
Because they were wonderful experiences at the time. They were the life that I had and my partner had at the time. They did or didn't have children. They were that living experience at the time. And then they didn't work sufficiently for one or other or both of us, and we both moved on. But that doesn't stop you going into the process and trying. It does mean it'd be pretty smart, in my case, since I'm the common factor, to recognize that there's something that I'm doing that ain't working. To the best of my ability, I've done that.
But there's so many people out there that don't even start something because they have the fear of failure or in some cases fear of success. And yet you seem to just do one thing after another, and after three or four wives, you just keep going, and then you even marry one a second time.
Well, no, I don't just keep going. No, I don't keep going. I wanted to leave with you the fact that if I did keep going in that way, that would be brainless and irresponsible.
Sure.
The brainful way and the responsible way is to say, hey, Malcolm, drop to it. This is your fourth and fifth wife. There's something you're not doing. There's something you're not fulfilling. There's something you're not succeeding in. And that's not a fear of success or failure. That's just plain pragmatism. You've got to look at it and say, that ain't working. Now I'm going to do it differently. I'm not sure I'm hitting center on what you're asking.
No, absolutely you are. I'm just asking you the questions because there's so many people out there that I come across that just won't even give it a go. And you sit there going, well, why wouldn't you? The worst thing that'll happen is you'll learn something from it. And hearing from someone like you who's given it a go more than once, twice, three more times than most people, you're a great example of saying, look, you know, I've been through it, and you have no regrets. You've learned a lot. People around you have learned a lot. Yes, there are people who might have hurt feelings, and yes, it might have been, you know, a little bit messy and you know, having all these disjointed families over, you know, last 30, 40 years. But in the end, when you look back, you're looking at it from the perspective is it's what made you who you are today. And that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you, because hearing your voice and hearing the level of conviction that you have, to me, is heartening, because what I find is people don't have a sense of conviction today. Do you find that as well over the course of your life, that the convictions that you had when you were younger, and I'm 48, but I feel like when I was younger, we had a feeling of conviction, a feeling of belief of how the world was and how we should be in it. Do you feel that we've kind of lost that?
I think so, but I want to give you an example first, and then I'll answer that question in relation to how my children live. Now, I'm in a hospice. There are older people than me here. They are certainly more inexorably nearer death than me. I have lunch with some of them, and one of them, a dear man, told me that he wakes up on a Thursday morning and thinks it's Thursday. I'll see Malcolm. He's got lots of jokes. I'll come in on Thursday. And for the rest of the week, he doesn't want to wake up. He died 2 weeks ago. So the issue is you either take stuff on and find a reason to be, or you don't. And I know that the lack of taking something on, the lack of running the risk of fear of failure, is in itself life-threatening.
Yeah.
You've only got to look at the relation between a psychological state and the immune system state. Look at the rate of death of spouses after their partner has died in decades.
Yeah.
Within two, three months, five months, the lawns have been cut, the house is in great shape, and people are wondering what they do. Well, they can either take on Tai Chi or philosophy classes or join their children's school or what they can do. They can either do that, or they can wake up in the morning and say, what a bastard, I've woken up, I wonder what tomorrow will be. Those are the choices.
Yeah, I mean,
so that's that side. But I want to tell you about the other one.
Sure.
Because the way technology has come in now, my children and everybody's children are instantaneous. When you watch people walking down the street, gosh, we wonder what we did before we had refrigerators, let alone after the horses were pulling the milk. These, at least half to three quarters of people, are texting. So they're in virtual space. So they have no, that's their social contact. But I don't find that they have any sense of the fact that in Libya today there's a new Muslim movement who's intending to separate a secular state from a religious state. I don't see them looking at the fact that an Australian has won a $10,000 prize to get water out of drought air. I don't see them looking at stuff like that.
No.
And getting behind it. There are some, and boy, am I happy to support them. There are some. But the others are living in instant space, but it's not the space that I understand. It's not a space that's got an objective or a goal that's beyond where they are, unless they become committed.
Correct.
To stuff. And I'm fortunate that my kids have followed me into gyms 3 years ago, and now they've been self-motivated to go to gym. Why? because they find that their body is better off and they are better off in that state. They go to one of the employments and they work regularly. So they too are showing the perseverance and the commitment in a manner which moves them out of the zone now into something where they can plan and look forward and see how much a car is going to cost and vary that sort of stuff. But in general, the youth of the world has moved into a form of instantaneity that is not part of a long-term view, and that's the difference.
Yeah, they're losing the skills to be able to deal with the fact that they're going to live beyond tomorrow.
That's it.
So looking at three groups of people, what suggestions would you have for them? So let's look at the teens and the people in their 20s, so the young people, the really young generation. When you sit there, reflecting on the life that you've lived and seeing the transformation that the world has had over your lifetime and looking at this now in 2011 and seeing what's going to happen over the next, 10 years that you can predict from a technological point of view and from a social perspective, someone who's in their teens right now, what suggestions would you have or what advice would you give them for them to get themselves oriented in a way that you believe would be beneficial for them and society?
Well, in the first instance, it is about survival, and depending upon your circumstances, it's better not to look outside yourself for your financial and physical survival.
Yep,
so it's smart if you're thinking about at school, getting an education, getting to the level that you possibly can, and then as my elder son of the two doing final exams at the moment says, "Oh, bother, I'll turn this off, excuse me."
That's
sorry
right.
About that. I don't know who it is. I've just had to turn it off.
Sure.
So, he has the dichotomous choice of becoming a tradesperson or somebody at university. He's covering both options with equal panache. And the trade option will give him income and the university option will give him a much delayed income. But they have to be thinking in those terms, because if they don't get the requisite educational experience, they don't even have the choice.
But when you and I were younger, and I say that because I have a bias, we grew up believing that if you work hard, or if you study and you make the investment now, the payoff will be there. Kids today don't seem to believe that because they see their parents unemployed, they see their parents struggling, having issues, with the global financial crisis, the housing market, and, people around the world seem to be struggling, with the debt crisis in Europe and what have you. So somehow they've lost the faith that if they make the investment now, it's going to pay off. I don't have that belief now. I don't even have it for young people now, but they seem as a group, and again, I'm generalizing, seem to have that. What can you tell them, what could you tell them to get them to think differently beyond the here and now and the today and next week, and feeling that, well, I'm not going to study because I'm going to go out with my mates because it's going to be fun tonight rather than getting an A or high distinction in an exam in 2 or 3 days from now?
Mm. I have to say, Mark, there are some things I know and some things I don't know. And this phase of life, A, I'm not in that age group. I've just got the fortune of being a father as a pseudo grandfather by 20 odd years over every other parent at the school, so I'm not totally informed about that. And the state of the world is such that if you look at the economics, the place is in the crisis. That if anybody couldn't read it 2 or 3 years ago, I don't know what they were looking at. So it's happened by October, November 2011. No surprise. So if they're looking at that, if they're watching the news or reading the newspaper and looking at the nonsense and equivocations that are going on in Greece and Italy, no damn wonder they shrug their shoulders and say, this is all too damn difficult. To which I say to my children, it'd be a lot more difficult if you didn't have a form of income that put petrol in the car because you couldn't even get out and look for a job. And the only way that's going to happen is to inform yourself and arm yourself. And you can only arm yourself in two ways. You can know more so that people will recognize that you're informed, and therefore when you apply with your CV as one out of 112 applicants for something, you've got some chance of picking it up. And I think the only, it's almost not rational to say to them, look, stop despairing. Despair is not a viable philosophy. Pessimism doesn't work. There's only optimism. You have to work in an optimistic space. You mightn't be able to see it now, but believe me, I've been there and I know pessimism doesn't work either. So the optimism is the way to go. So yes, go out tonight with your mates, but there are 7 nights in a week. I don't want to see you doing 3 to 4 hours on your Xbox and a half an hour on your study, no matter how smart you are. Unfortunately, I've got some bad news for you. You actually have to work. So the best that you can do is divide your time. Not, I don't tell the kids they can't do this, that, and the other. I say try and balance your time in a manner which is appropriate for you to arm yourself with the requisite information. And that's frankly the best I can do to my children. And I don't know that an old fellow like me can do much more to others. So that's that age group, and I'm acknowledging I don't know too much about it. But and then look around for people who have similar interests. Look around for people who have similar interests. So if you like touch rugby, find touch rugby. If you like the violin and the band, find someone with violin and the band. Get with groups who can support you in being the person that you might like to become. You don't know yet. But certainly if you can move from just being yourself into a group of like-minded people, then there's satisfaction in that anyway at a social level. And it also helps you in the manner that I've described.
So someone who's in midlife, you know, the people who are basically complacent or just coasting, and they don't have much direction or purpose, what would be your suggestion, and how did you deal with your midlife stage, if you will, and how did you get that drive to continue? Because, you know, you're in your 70s, and you still have that drive. So why did
you... I reckon I've been in my midlife forever.
Yeah.
I guess the answer to that is I noticed that the people who have the right property that's freehold and have the right income, there's actually damn all incentive for them to do anything about it unless life becomes less attractive as it is and people are looking around and having affairs and doing all and creating social parties where monogamy is no longer seems to be of a social value. So, you know, those people aren't going to change too much other than find some interest at the edges. For those in middle age for whom it's not working, it's damn difficult. I was chair of the parent board of the school, the development and community boards, and I'm watching people who are the parents of kids who have been hit over the last year or two, and they simply can't keep the kids, even at Cardinia International College, which is a medium cost school. And I have difficulty too. Anne and I live on Centrelink, so because try getting a job at a regular job at 71 when you've got a diagnosis that I have. So I choose, in my case, to look at what I can do and realize that sitting in a bed in a hospice or at home in front of a computer, I can do stuff where I can be sufficiently attractive to be paid for by the people in Brisbane to go to Brisbane and the people in China to go to China and so on. So I create for myself the circumstances where I'm still contributing. I mightn't be surviving in the best possible way, but at least I've arranged to manage it. But boy, I don't want to underestimate how hard it is for the 45 and 55-year-olds at this time when there's such sizable cutdowns in both white-collar and blue-collar jobs. It's another area where a lot of people are looking and struggling, and I don't have any great smarts. In terms of people of my age, you know, they what's the conversation about as to whether or not retirement's at 67 or 65? Frankly, who gives a rat's? What's 2 years going to do unless you're actually doing something that it's worthwhile continuing to work for? Most people are saying, I don't want to work for another 2 years. I want to retire. But when they retire, I don't know what they're doing with their retirement, because when they come home, sometimes they're more of a onerous presence than they might have hoped. So for those people, I think what you've got to do, one of my friends, a professor of immunology, progressively moved himself into water painting, and is an artist, and then gained a teaching group by taking people on. So he made a smooth transition from retirement at 65 to what he does now. So I think for the people in that age group, if you can, find something that might be four-wheel drives in the outback Australia. It might be a lot of things. But find something where you can spend in organized anticipation the years before retirement and then work into them such that when everybody gives you a golden handshake and something or other else, the next day is least disruptive to your life and most satisfying to your life. And you can say, well, I had that phase and now I've got this new phase. This is going to be fantastic because I already know quite a bit about it. And now I'll be able to spend 40 hours a week on it, not four.
But you're actually advocating that you're still working, and here you are in the final stages of your life, and you're actually still working and not taking a retirement. You're on your laptop, inspiring other people, but also doing your medical research. Mm. So how does that fit in, and why would you advocate that that's the way to go?
Frankly, Mark, after the life I've led, if I stop doing stuff, I might as well sort of commit Harry Carey. So there's no chance that myself or my close colleague, Dr. Brian Tate, or somebody else, there's no chance we can retire. We're just going to go till we drop. And that's how we've been. And that's how we'll go. We have the choice, of course, like I said, to stop and develop water painting. But in my case, I just find that I'm bringing to a further development, and in that process, convergence towards completion, in an area where I think the world's going to benefit. So why on earth would I stop spending whatever time I possibly can? But I'm not advocating mine as a regular situation. Mine is one where I basically set out a plan, I don't know, 40 years ago, and I could keep going for another 40 or 400 years, and it wouldn't make any difference. But I've got what I'm doing is learning to pass the baton. Boy, for me, is that difficult, because I've spent my life finding out that if I do it myself, it works, and if I try to get somebody else to do it, it takes me longer to pick it up and do it myself. But I'm still trying to pass the baton and relegate and delegate, and I've done that to a surprising degree, actually, so that gives me satisfaction too, because if I'm getting to that point, then I'll be able to say, you know, I didn't retire, but I was retired.
So some people feel that people who do what you do are basically slaves to their careers or to their businesses. But you don't sound like you're a slave. And
no, I get that all the time. We went down to Bowen Heads for a rest, and people said, but he works all the time. But work for me is pleasure. Mm. That's not work at all. That's pleasure. That's what I'm doing. And I stop and have a break and walk down the beach and live it that way. So everybody has the mindset that, oh, dear, he's working. Good Lord, how's he keep going for 20 hours a day as I do in this place? Right? They say, well, look, there's nowhere on earth you're going to have a chance to sleep and rest. And my answer to that is, well, one day I'll have a long sleep and I don't need the practice.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. Out of all of the skills and abilities that you've acquired, as well as other people that you've been witness to that have accomplished things in life, what do you think the three skills or abilities you would suggest people develop? Like, I'm talking general abilities here, that you think are, you know, the cornerstones of a successful, fulfilling, happy life and successful career.
Decide what you're passionate about.
Yeah.
Decide what moves you, what inspires you, what turns you on. So find out what you're passionate about, and boy, if you haven't got something, find it, because of all the activities that there are in the world, there must be something that causes a twinkle in your eye. Having found that, then you commit to it, and you apply it with sustained perseverance. And stuff will come and stuff will go, like waves on the shore or anywhere else. And you have to follow it through the difficult waves and enjoy the ride through the ones that aren't so good. Don't focus on, my God, that was difficult, it was difficult, it was difficult. No. Search out the 5%. Sometimes that's all it is. Search out the 5% where everything works and gave you a real turn on. and just talk about the turn on. That's the optimistic part. And then the third thing is see it through. So having got your passion, having got a sustaining approach, see it through to a completion and then let it go. And then be able to pass it on to others by recognizing that life comes to an end for all of us. And if it's really that good and that worthwhile, then let it like the doves that are released on your funeral, let it fly.
That's an interesting one. I didn't expect to let it go.
Well, otherwise, what I can imagine happening in, again, 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, I actually hope it's 6, 8, 12 months,
sure.
And don't let anybody listening to this misunderstand, I'm looking for 6, 8, 10, 12 years.
Yes.
But if that's the case, I'll be able to say, this one's got hold of that, this one's got hold of that, the society's doing this, somebody's doing that, the Americans have released the chair of the International Committee in America, they're doing that. And smile and think, by gosh, you know, one person got that going. It doesn't matter a damn, really, whether you're recognized or not, because if it works, somebody sometime will say, as they do with anybody in history who's contributed, like Mendel, take Mendel. Mendel wasn't recognized in 1868. It took 30 years. There were 3 mentions to him in 30 years, and then he was acknowledged 3 times by 3 different scientists in 3 different countries who, fortunately, all gave him prior recognition. But it doesn't matter if he got none, as long as the abbot didn't burn all his papers, which he nearly did.
But that's the problem with today's society is they figure, well, you know, if I'm only going to be recognized, you know, 50, 60, 100 years after my death, why would I care? Why would I make that investment when they're not going to benefit from it? And that's where, you know, when you look at your holistic perspective in life, and I share it with you, that you're doing this for the greater good.
Yeah, today's, but the benefit's in your experience. The benefit's in your experience. Did you feel good? Did you feel satisfied? Did you feel it was worthwhile? Do you feel enriched? And if you feel enriched and if you feel your passion has been contributed, stop running a referendum.
Mm.
The pollies keep telling us each morning we don't look at the polls. Stop running a referendum. If you're doing what it is you think you should be doing and it's working for you and you can sit there and have the cup of tea and look at the sun shining like that and say, by gosh, that was worthwhile. It doesn't matter the proverbial. Whether you've got one person who recognizes or an army.
You just mentioned the beauty of of the sun. And usually you hear about people who are dying, who get the pleasure and the joy of the simplest things, sunshine, you know, the lick of a puppy, you know, the feel of the water in between their toes on the beach, and how they can relish that. Why do you think that we who don't have that sense of mortality don't enjoy it to the fullest that we actually should?
Because facing immortality is a threat. Nobody, particularly when you're young, emotionally comprehends that life is not interminable. And frankly, there are periods of time where I'm still in denial. You can hear it in my voice from time to time. I'm still playing the game both ways. But if you haven't got any reason to even think of playing it the alternative way, you don't.
Are you in denial or are you in acceptance?
There are times I'm having to work very hard. Oh, bother. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I am having to work very hard to be in acceptance because the way in which I get so much satisfaction and pleasure and the passion that drives and sustains me means I have difficulty imagining that I'm not going to be here to experience it. That's a fact. But I'm working very hard to be accepting of the process.
But whenever I hear...
To that extent, I'm providing alternative possibility.
Whenever,
go ahead.
Whenever we've had our conversations over the last couple of years, I've never sensed any sense of denial. What I've sensed is a very mature, very advanced level of acceptance, an acceptance not of death, but of of the situation with the courage and the tenacity of victory, but definitely not of denial of
I'm not agreeing to denial. Yeah. The word was acceptance,
yeah.
And the issue is fluctuating between acceptance and less acceptance. That's a fact.
Fair enough. Yes, I'll grant you that one.
I accept where I am,
yeah.
Even though just this morning, about 2 hours ago, I rounded the end of the bed, touched my skin on it, and it came off like papyrus. And I look at it and think, for heaven's sake, is this the guy who was playing market squash in 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And the rest, and I'm having to say, yep. But there's a gap between that reality and where my mindset is. And to that extent, to that extent, I'm not in full acceptance. That's what I mean, lesser than complete acceptance. Okay. But then I say and watch myself and see what happens and say, I've got to look at the facts. I'm a physician. I've treated people with my disease. And I've got to look at the facts and say, Malcolm, if this is the myeloma that's progressing in this way, then there's a distinct chance that you won't be able to stem the tide. And that's that moves me towards an acceptance. And then I cry some of the time. Are you there?
Yes, I am. I am. I'm just listening to what you're saying. And
I'm sorry. So then I get closer to complete acceptance. But don't make any mistake, and nobody listening should make any mistake either. I don't relish the thought of not being here to see the grandchildren. I've got one son and his wife and children in Germany. I'm not close to them like I'd like to be. So there's a situation where I'd like to improve. So I'm not saying that everything's complete. It's damn near. It's got to be in the 95% bus. But that's because I've arranged it. That's because I've been working on it. And that's because I'm privileged to have partners and family and others who seem to be, who seem to find it possible to be with me while I do this. And but there are times when, you know, I cried. I cried. One of my friends, a professor at Alfred Hospital, lost his wife on Sunday morning. I've got some prescient sense. I sent him a text 20 minutes after she died. And he said to me, how did you know? Did you get a call? I said, I didn't get a call. I said, how do you know? Well, I know. And I've done it before.
Yeah.
And my prescient sense is, Malcolm, face it. There's no point in doing too much sleeping. Now, if people get that message at any stage of the day, at any age in life, including the drivers in their 20s who've just got their license, my son's just got his license, who think that life is interminable. No, it's not, and you better live it in a manner which is in your best interests to ensure that it is for as long as possible. And doesn't matter whether you're in any one of those three age categories you talked about before, the issues are the same. The issues are the same. To be appreciative of the fact that you've got a chance to be passionate. I notice that people are taking their own lives, farmers are taking their own lives, people are jumping off Westgate Bridge and the rest, and I'm working my eyeballs out to try and stay alive. I wish it was possible to get it enough for them. Maybe there are some people on the call now who are listening and wondering whether it's all worth it. Well, I can't tell you what it's like on the other side, but it's short as hell seems to be more viable on this side than anything that might be there.
Hmm. Why did you want to do this interview? I mean, you know, you've got a lot of things to do, and Why bother spend the hour?
Oh, the answer to that's simple, because I admire the way what you're doing. I think that your approach to exponential growth is fantastic. I like your energy and your voice. And so that's one thing. This is a personal support to you and your activity. The second thing is that this is a way in which there might be some one person only out there who listens to this guy and says, damn it, Dave, if he can do it at the stage he's at, what am I talking about? I thought that was a pain I had in my chest. And he tells me, well, he didn't tell you. You know, I've got broken ribs all over the place. So if he can do it, what am I thinking about? And if there's just one person out there who thinks that way, then the call has been worthwhile.
See, that's why I wanted to do this call, because very few people can have a conversation with someone that's in your situation, and I don't have the acceptance of a couple days, couple weeks, couple months. You know, I have the view that I can be in denial for you, and yet I felt compelled to request from you to have this call for people that will transcend your reach, my reach, and I know that the ripple that we can create, the small ripple that we put in a pond when we drop a little pebble, and those ripples, you know, I believe go to infinity.
And I don't
know where I learned that or where I started believing it, you know, and I've believed it my whole life, you know, from a very, very young age. And for that, I want to thank you for doing this, because I know that you want to do it, but I want to acknowledge to you for people who listen to this recording that even though you want to do it, the fact that you did it is testimony to your commitment. And I guess in wrapping up this conversation, you've had the benefit and the disadvantage of dying at what some people call a slow death. You were diagnosed, you know, close to 10 years ago, having to go through treatments, people telling you you don't have a long time to live, outliving that by orders of magnitude and coming up with some fantastic methods of regaining your health. And you've had the opportunity to be able to wrap things up. How do you feel about having had that opportunity versus getting hit by that proverbial bus and not being able to have that? Do you feel that that's been a burden or an advantage?
An absolute privilege. My feet are on the ground. Just have a look at the last 10 years. There's only one person that could possibly have been... but if you want to become a little bit metaphysical about it and you wonder about where we started this conversation, which is what does one voice count, do some physics. The butterfly that's flapping in the Amazon changes the climate over Australia. So that might be difficult for you to imagine, but actually there are simplified descriptions of that. So what everybody can imagine is that in the last 10 years, I've had 3,500 days worth of opportunity. What's the alternative?
But the pain, the discomfort, you know, the sleepless nights, the pain
What do I do if I took them away? what would I do if I took them? Well, no. Hang on a minute. There's no voluntary choice for euthanasia here.
I'm not advocating euthanasia. I'm advocating talking about getting hit by a bus inadvertently because, you know, you don't see it coming and having to go through the pain and discomfort that you've suffered over the last several years.
Yeah, well, getting hit by a bus is not something that's voluntary.
Correct.
That happens.
Yep.
So, you know, I don't even see them on the same page, Mark.
Sure.
I'm just simply saying some people have that happen to them and that's how it is. Well, if I got hit by a bus, then I wasn't looking. But that's quite different from what I'm trying to do with managing the myeloma. Bother, I'm sorry, they're vacuuming the floor. So
we can't hear it. It's okay. We don't hear it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if it interferes, let them know. So my closing message to everyone out there is stop wondering whether it's worthwhile. Find whatever is worthwhile. Find what turns you on. And go for it. And in the process, in your prioritizing, decide your survival is important. How best can you achieve that in this incredibly disruptive world where prediction is not easy to imagine? But try and get as much of that as possible behind you. And what you don't get behind you, try and position yourself so that you can indeed have food on the table. Unfortunately, that's where we are now. We would never have imagined that 20 years ago, but that's where the world is now. So whether you're a teenager or a middle age or you're my age, you know, that you've got to reconcile your passion with the processes of survival. And then having done that, enjoy it. even if it's only 5% of the total time. Put a smile on your face, because who the hell wants to see a long one? I feel bad when I'm down and people come to me and say, oh, he must be in pain, he must be... I know I'm failing. I know I'm failing. And there are times here where I'm not succeeding to the extent that I want. How is success defined? That when people leave here, they feel it was worthwhile coming and they want to come back. And that's whether I'm in a hospice or walking around town. That's the criterion.
I know this won't be my last conversation with you, but for people who are listening to this, they might want to know, they might want to know, how would you like to be remembered? They'll remember this call because this hour that we spent together is timeless. But how would you like to be remembered? What would be your last thoughts, your last memory that you'd like to have, whoever's listening to this recording or reading the transcript of this recording?
Frankly, Mark, it doesn't matter, because I can't influence that. The people out there who have that reaction that you're talking about, that to know that there may be people there like that, frankly, that's satisfying enough. But at the that's the indefinite part, and that's the source of living. But the definite part is I frankly would like to be recognized for the contribution I've made to the scientific process. And to understanding the nature of knowing in the world. What is the cosmological basis of the universe? How does biogenesis, how did life start in the manner that it did? And that sort of stuff. I would like to be seen as part of that intellectual evolutionary process of the nature of knowing in terms of mankind.
Fantastic. On that note, Malcolm, I want to thank you on behalf of the person who's listening to this or reading a transcript for sharing, you know, an entire hour of your life that hopefully will have the benefit for the person who's listening, or hopefully they'll pass this on to someone who needs that inspiration. I can tell you that my life has been forever changed. When we came across our paths through a passion that we both shared of playing squash, we quickly realized that squash was just an introduction point. Because even though we have talked a little bit about squash, we've talked much more about existential, holistic life moments, if you will. And as you mentioned, you know, very few of those moments were talking about your illness and the tribulations of what that entails. And for that, I'm forever grateful. So I want to thank you on behalf of the people who will be listening to this. And personally, for taking the time. Thank you very much, Malcolm.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll edit that. At the end of that, how did you feel about that? I thought that was fantastic.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, I mean, it worked for me.
Your voice sounds fantastic. Like I told you the last time, you sound healthier now than you did a year ago.
Well, it comes and it goes, Mark. A year ago... October 2010, I was not in good shape. And so, you know, I go up and down too. And there are periods of time when the treatment's working, and there are other times when I'm a bloody menace to be around. And those are the sorts of times that I'm in most denial, least acceptance, and I'm most difficult to live with. And it's only actually in the last period of time that my wife could possibly say that I'm at least starting to think that there's a possibility that I don't see myself well. And as late as this morning, I have to say that when I, you know, trip on my shoes and fall into the bed and take my skin off my hand. So, you know, we've got to learn as we go.
How's your hospice? How is that?
The hospice is 6+.
Yeah.
Star. I mean, this is unbelievable. This is utterly unbelievable. I've got 2 to 3 people here watching me 24 hours of the day. I just got to ring a bell.
Yeah.
And it's just a perfect place. I mean, I'm just, you know, I don't know. Somehow or other, in most of my life, if a cat's got 9 lives, I've got at least 19. and just being here gives me the sense of your... alternative and there's no way I'm going to die in hospital because I've got the fantastic choice of dying at home, which is my preference, or if something happened that was too sick or too something or something, then I've got here. And third place is a palliative care hospital. So to have those choices is just incomprehensible.
Yeah, I mean, in modern society, we have things that, you know, a lot of people take for granted and they don't realize that the social network is there.
The social network here, the hierarchical network, just can't be exceeded. I mean, when I compare this to Germany or New Zealand or England, forget about Indonesia or China, you know, this place is off the map. That's how it is.
Yeah, it's you don't realize it until you need to realize it.
Mm-hmm.
So, anything else you want to discuss today?
No. Thank you very much. I thank you on the call for the opportunity.
Yep.
And
I'll get the recording to you.
Thank you for the offer and thank you for the opportunity today, which I don't see as anything other than a high value use of my time. Okay.
Fantastic. Thanks, Malcolm.
And Anna's saying in the background, say hi from her.
Right? She's there.
She just walked in the room.
Oh, excellent. Well, say hi to her for me.
She didn't hear nothing. Walked in the room.
Okay, and then so then she'll be happy to hear the interview the first time as a recording.
Yep, that's it.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Thanks, Malcolm.
Good man.
Bye-bye
now.
Okay, bye.